Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Storm Bert is bringing further widespread disruption, with public transport badly affected after devastating flooding over the weekend. Several rail operators, including Southern and Great Western Railway, have cancelled services this morning. Drivers will also face struggles with severely flooded streets. REC spokesman Rod Dennis offers his advice for road users.
The best advice is, yes, a much more cautious driving style over the winter. If you're used to charging about everywhere, this is not the time when you want to be doing that. You want to be reducing those speeds and keeping yourself, passengers and other road users safe.
Thousands of bar staff will be trained to deal with incidents of spiking under government plans, as Sir Keir Starmer demands joint action from police and hospitality chiefs today to tackle violence against women and girls. Workers in the nighttime economy will be instructed on how to prevent cases, support victims and help collect evidence by spring next year. And Manchester United drew 1-1 against Ipswich Town yesterday, a defeat which new head coach Ruben Amorim says will leave the club suffering for a long period. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Liv Thompson.
Get 8 months half price on all Virgin Media Business broadband packages. Well, it is Black Friday. Plus, you'll get a fixed price guarantee. Yep, we know you're always at full tilt. So we're at half price. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband. Virgin Media. See what you can do. Virgin Fibre areas only. 24-month contract ends 11th of December. Legal stuff
applies. Coming up, metaphorically speaking.
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert. Nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
NHS England is launching the next phase of their Pharmacy First advertising campaign that raises awareness of the expanded services available at your community pharmacy. Those services mean that pharmacists can now provide some prescription medicine, if needed, for 7 common conditions without the need to see a GP first. Going to your local pharmacy offers an easy and convenient way to get clinical advice on minor health concerns. And now community pharmacies can offer treatment and, when appropriate, some prescription medicine for 7 common conditions without GP appointment. This is part of a major transformation in the way the NHS delivers care. Community pharmacies are staffed by highly skilled and qualified health professionals who are trusted parts of local communities. Pharmacists can train for 5 years in the use of medicines before they qualify and are also trained in clinically assessing and treating minor illnesses and giving health and well-being advice to help people stay well. Pharmacy technicians are part of the pharmacy team and are also registered health professionals.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio. Colorful.
Delia. Delore. Colorful Radio.
Hi there, and welcome to Metaphorically Speaking. I'm Delia Delore, and each week we dissect a popular motto, mantra, or metaphor, looking at their origins and finding how they translate to everyday life. Our special guest is author Nicola Morrison, and she joins me to discuss the significance of this metaphor and the manner in which it resonates with her. Now, I say with this metaphor, I'm going to give you a little clue, and let's see whether you can get it. You know, sometimes you just feel trapped. You just feel like you're kind of neither here nor there, but you, every time you try to make a movement, something has happened, something that's beyond your control happens, and it just frustrates you, really. But you want to be triumphant, you want to be strong, so you try your best to get out of this cage. Any idea? Well, let's see whether you can guess it this way. In the words of Maya Angelou, a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied. So he opens his throat to sing. Harkening back to the late 1960s, specifically the zeitgeist captured by the anthropomorphic nature of the caged bird, the Beatles' Blackbird entered the national consciousness of America. The at first glance innocuous song became synonymous with the plight of the Little Rock Nine, who, prior to an intervention by President Dwight Eisenhower, were prevented from attending a racially segregated school in Little Rock, Arkansas. Paul McCartney described writing the song in Scotland as a show of support to the wider civil rights movement in America, with Blackbird serving as a metaphor for a black girl. Similarly to Angelou's idea of the bird being held back by its physical caging, McCartney's lyrics speak of a bird being held back by its broken wings. Have you guessed the metaphor yet? Of course it is, from what Maya Angelou has said, caged bird. A similar idiom, a canary in the coal mine, developed from miners carrying canaries with them to check for the relative levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the air, metaphorically represents the suffering of a marginalized group serving as a warning to others. In the context of the Little Rock Nine, the danger continued widespread discrimination if policy change was not pursued. Interestingly, it appears then that the idea of the bird representing struggle is far-reaching within our society.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night, take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Maya Angelou hearkened back to the caged bird anthropomorphism with the release of her 1969 memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, detailing her experiences growing up in racially segregated Arkansas and subsequently in her poem Caged Bird, published in 1983. The use of a caged bird as a metaphor has not only been used to describe the African-American experience in the mid-20th century, but even earlier to describe the female experience, particularly in a downtrodden or oppressive environment. The 1900 parlor song, A Bird in a Gilded Cage, by Arthur J. Lamb and Harry von Tilzer, and recorded most notably by Steve Porter, describes the difficulties faced by a young woman married to a rich older man that she doesn't love.
He's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see. You may think he's happy and free from care, he's not so fitting to be.
It is therefore interesting, given the metaphor's origin in popular culture nearly 125 years ago, that it has survived into the work of one of the most celebrated artists of modern time, Kendrick Lamar. In the music video for Not Like This, Lamar's record-breaking diss track aimed at Canadian superstar Drake, Lamar is shown closing the door on a caged owl at the video's conclusion, in reference to Drake's record label OVO, which is often symbolized by an owl. The metaphor in this instance is portrayed as Lamar as an external force putting Drake, who he sees as the oppressor stealing from a culture that is not his own, into the cage, thus reclaiming back what is his, a theme communicated in the wider context of the song. In a review of the song for Rolling Stone magazine, Andre Gee stated the song was more than just a diss track and took the form of a rally against perpetrators who shifted hip-hop away from a black and brown community into an, at times, parodic circus. Indeed, Lamar pays reference to colonizers using black culture within the hip-hop community to further their own careers, despite having no real link or care for black culture, drawing a comparison to the slave labor that built Atlanta's bustling railroad industry in the mid-19th century.
Once upon a time, all of us was in chains. Homies still doubled down, calling us some slaves. Atlanta was the mecca, building railroads and trains. Bear with me for a second, let me put y'all on game. The settlers was using town folk to make them richer. Fast forward 2024, you got the same agenda.
So having seen the metaphor of the caged bird being used for over a century to describe the plight of various marginalized groups, what is it about the idea of the entrapped and, most importantly, winged creature that makes it so appropriate for use in that context? Both the physiological form of the bird as well as its nature are part of the reason why the idea of a bird in a cage works well to explain a lack of freedom. The cage prevents the bird from spreading its wings whilst also preventing the bird from taking flight, connoting that in the context of marginalization, there is an external force. In this case, the cage stopping the bird from fulfilling its full potential to be what it is supposed to be. Angelou's line, "So he opens his throat to sing," is a powerful statement that in the bleakest of scenarios, people will find a way to express themselves and protest against their situation. Returning to Lamar, for example, in the midst of widespread anger over police brutality in the United States in 2015, his song All Right, and its chorus in particular, became an anthem of defiance for the African-American community.
Be all right.
Of course, as we've explored the obvious physiological consequences to the entrapment, the bird unable to spread its wings or fly. But what about mentally? Many who find themselves in situations where they are caged struggle to escape the mindset and the trauma they have faced even when they are brought their freedom. This is a topic Lamar covers on the song Institutionalized, stating, "I'm trapped inside of the ghetto, and I ain't proud to admit it. Institutionalized. I keep running back for a visit." In Lamar's case, despite the fame and fortune that his career has brought him, he finds it impossible to escape the negative mindset that growing up in an oppressed environment has given him. He may be free financially, but mentally, like the bird, he is trapped. The idea of mental entrapment is one that serves as a key theme in much of Lamar's work, but most notably on the album To Pimp a Butterfly, in which particularly on the final track Mortal Man, Lamar presents the allegory of the caterpillar and the butterfly.
The caterpillar is a prisoner to the streets that conceived it. Its only job is to eat or consume everything around it in order to protect itself from this mad city. While consuming this environment, the caterpillar begins to notice ways to survive. One thing it notices is how much the world shuns him, but praises the butterfly. The butterfly represents the talent, the thoughtfulness, and the beauty within the caterpillar. But having a harsh outlook on life, the caterpillar sees the butterfly as weak and figures out a way to pimp it to its own benefits.
I'm very pleased to say that today my wonderful guest is editor and former BBC broadcast journalist Nicola Morrison. It's safe to say that Nicola possesses an impressive set of credentials, ranging from scaling the dizzy heights of one of the largest corporations in the world and reporting on some of the most memorable stories of the 21st century to overcoming a series of harrowing personal challenges. Despite such adversity, Nicola's demonstrated strength culminates in the 2024 release of her autobiographical book, Victory Is My Name. Her accomplishments, personally and professionally, are nothing short of victorious. Nicola, thank you so much for being a guest on Metaphorically Speaking. We are honoured to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure.
Well, when I heard what your metaphor was going to be, I had this big smile on my face. And then it also reminded me that I have not read the book for so many years. Mm-hmm. It was embarrassing to think about how long ago I had read it. And it prompted me to purchase a copy, a downloaded copy, so that I can read on my next flight, so that I have enough time. And then I thought, well, of course, I need to get my hands on your book as well, because based on what I've read in terms of the synopsis of your book, and based on Maya Angelou, it made me think, I can see something going on here. So I thought, well, who else but to ask if you saw any kind of similarity between yourself and Dr. Angelou and your book? So as a person and as an author.
Oh, that's a really good question. Dr. Maya Angelou is one of my favourite writers, along with Toni Morrison. That's a really good question. I think personally, I can relate to her being the tallest in her class, being a bit awkward and not quite fitting in, and probably not being the desirable at the teenage time. I was one of those awkward, tall kids, a bit like her. And also, I guess she experienced hardship in her early years as well. And she turned that into something so beautiful. She turned that into a victorious dance, as opposed to being a victim of her circumstances. So I guess now that you ask, that I can draw on quite a few similarities between us, and maybe that's why she's evolved to be one of my favourite writers, other than the fact that she's absolutely amazing at what she did. And then in terms of the poems and how the metaphors really kind of resonated with me, I think Caged Bird really does speak to my experience, definitely feeling caged in, helpless at times, especially in my earlier years, and feeling like I wanted to get out, needed to get out, but didn't know what that meant or what that looked like, feeling a bit lost and a bit stuck. That poem really does resonate with me as well.
So you chose the metaphor caged bird. Metaphors are stories. And metaphors, I keep saying this to people because I just find it amazing that most metaphors in modern day, they are perceived to be mostly negative than they are positive. Whereas historically, they were seen as positive ways, positive interpretations, and ways that instead of having to tell a whole story, you could just drop a metaphor, drop a quote, drop a line, and you just get it. So why did you choose Caged Bird, which was your adaptation of Dr. Angelou's title?
I think the best way to explain it is kind of echoing what you said in terms of the metaphor really breaks down barriers and it makes something much easier to understand. So you don't have to know everything about a person. A metaphor can really bring you straight in to the narrative, and you can have that kind of collective understanding despite your background, despite their background, despite your different experiences. Sometimes a metaphor can really cut right through that. And I think we can all imagine a caged bird. We can all imagine that that sorrow that comes from knowing that that is a beautiful thing that has wings that span much wider than that cage would ever allow. And yet perhaps we will never get to recognize, nor will the bird ever get to recognize, just its capabilities and what it could achieve. And yet there is this the shrill that this bird has, where there's something in them that knows that they're meant for more. They don't know what that is because their experience is limited to that cage. But there's something in them that says, this is not what your story is meant to be, and this isn't how your story is meant to end. And that really resonates with me. As a child, I went through really bad racial abuse at school, physical violence, name calling was my day-to-day experience. Home life was tough. Family life in general was a really difficult dynamic. And then I had this feeling of not knowing where I was meant to be in this world or where I was meant to go. But I just felt like this wasn't meant to be my full story. There had to be a better life ahead out there somehow, somewhere. And so for me, that really resonates with me in terms of being limited by your circumstances, but having this innate desire within you to flourish and to spread your wings and find that, whatever that is.
Do you think that the title could be not understood the same way depending on your cultural background?
Oh, absolutely. It really depends if you understand the beauty of the bird. And I think in different cultures, depending on how tactile we are in terms of animals, I know I've got a puppy and I absolutely adore her. My family are from the Caribbean. Some of them get it. Some of them really don't get it. She's just a dog. She's just a dog. No, she's not. She's my best friend. She's sitting on my feet right now. So it does depend on your cultural experience. But I think that's the great thing about a metaphor, though. There's so many ways to interpret it, and you can't really control that as the author, because it is all subjective based on a person's experience. But that then brings so many layers to a metaphor, really, because even if you don't understand the beauty of the bird, and maybe you don't feel that emotive pull about, you know, the beauty of its wings and then being clipped, you can still maybe relate to the fact of how you would feel being caged, being alone, being your freedom being taken away, and sometimes depending on culturally where you're from, that's more relatable. But I think that's just the beauty of poetry as well, is that it really transports you and it pulls out things of your own experience and your own psyche that and your subconscious that you sometimes don't even know is there.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you're so right. And also, our interpretation being British would be a totally different interpretation of the African Caribbean or the African American, which, of course, Dr. Maya Angelou, that's where she was citing from her experiences as being an African American woman. And I have to remember when I first heard the title, I thought, what's this about? I couldn't understand why she would want to have a title of a book because a caged bird. I did not get it. I did not get the metaphor. And I remember when I first read it, there were some, from my memory, because it's many, many years since I read it, I remembered feeling, well, like you, being in the UK, subject to racism, and of course I'm many more years older than you, so it was a different type of racism, but it's still the same feeling. Doesn't matter how long ago, when someone calls you something that is not you, that is not your name, which refers to the color of your skin, I have to say that being in Britain, and I really don't mean this in any derogative way, I'm just telling the truth, I don't think that I was ever taught what it was to be a Black person in Britain, and that I should feel proud to be a Black person in Britain. But when I went to America and spent some time there and read Dr. Angelou's book, it made me feel, oh my gosh, she went through all these things, but yet she overcame all these things, and she embraced being Black, and she loved, you know, her culture. Do you feel that Caged Bird, do you feel that a title, a book title like that, can make someone think about how they feel being a person, not just a Black person, but being a person, a human being?
Yeah, definitely. I think that book and what you just touched on, I think is really valid. It about experiences and representation and perspective. And I think where Dr. Maya Angelou was speaking from was a place of really seeing something at its full potential. And when you talk about being Black British, and it's, I cover some of it in my book about when I was first aware that I was Black, I didn't know I was black. I didn't know I was anything. I was just a kid running around in the playground until someone told me I was black, and then worse still, told me that was not good. And I think when it comes to representation, I think African Americans are much further ahead than us in terms of diversity on screen, in terms of talent, in terms of the media. It's much more common when I was in the US, in New York, in Atlanta, to see black and brown faces on the screen when presenting the news and things like that. It definitely does change your perspective. It definitely does change what you think is possible and achievable. And even as you were speaking, I thought to myself, if the caged bird was caged for long enough, even if you opened that door, would it fly out? Would it know it could fly out? Would it know that was a possibility and an opportunity? It's hard to know.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Because they could just, you know, remain in fear, you know, or they may think about it and think, well, what do I do when I get out? Very true. So you wrote a book, Victory Is My Name. Why did you feel you need to write it?
That's a really good question as well, actually, because it kind of leads to the origin story of the book, which was actually that I don't feel like it was up to me. I really feel like God spoke to me about my story and my narrative and everything I'd been through. And it was kind of started off as some kind of cathartic process that I did during the pandemic. And it was just, I've got time. I've kind of always felt like I want to write stuff down, to becoming this big project that then formed into a book. The interesting thing about it is that I would always share snippets of my story with people. So you encounter people in your day-to-day life. I would do a lot of outreach with the homeless and with the elderly. And, you know, there'd be times when they would mention a loss or something they were struggling with that I could identify with. And I would share what I call a chapter of my life. And as I did that more and more, people would say to me, oh my goodness, you need to write a book, you know, humoring me. But there were times when I did think to myself, what if there are other people that my story could help that are out there? But I kind of, you know, put that to the back of my mind. Life's busy, get on with it. And then the pandemic happened and it was like, life's not really busy anymore. Mm. So like I say, I just started it as some kind of like, you know, exercise. It was just a way to pass the time. And as I got halfway through the book, I really felt like God was speaking to me and saying, actually, this book is not actually just for you. It's for other people. And at that point I stopped. I froze and I thought, oh no, I've been writing really freely and really honestly and really authentically, and now I'm aware that people are going to read it. I totally froze up. So for the second year of the pandemic, I was constantly battling through this kind of really wanting to write, then not writing, then overthinking, overanalyzing, leaving it alone. So there were times when months would go by and I wouldn't write. And then other days I'd be constantly writing. But when I did finish the book and I was just convinced it wouldn't go anywhere and that'd be the end of it. Little did I know that there was a lot of interest in the book. So once I knew that it was actually going to be published, I found a peace. I felt a peace with, do you know what, Nick, you've been through stuff and you haven't been through it in vain. And I'm very much a person that I believe you can go through stuff, but you're not what you've been through. So I felt there's a positive message that I want to share with the world. I want to empower people. I want to let people know that you can go through really, really hard times and still come out the other side. And sometimes I think the people that smile the hardest are the people that have been through the most, myself included.
Yes, I would agree with you there. So let's see if we can pique some interest so that we get people to read your book. Can you remember, whether you've put it in your book or not, where your crossroads began? What was it that made you think, you know what, I've been through all of this and now I want a different life? Can you remember that moment or a period of time?
I don't know if I had any kind of like epiphany moment other than when I came to Christ and I became a Christian. That was obviously a monumental period in my life. But I think I was like that caged bird. I was always hoping for a better future, but really not just seeing the reality. So growing up in a really difficult home situation, my parents are now divorced, but that was quite a contentious home life for many years before that happened. So that's your ecosystem. That's all you know. Then you go to school and you're suffering, you know, a lot of racism and abuse and being physically assaulted. So then there's that element. And then with all of that mixed in, you're starting to grapple with being Black, being female, worrying about your hair and that not being like everybody else. And there was just so many things that reminded me I didn't fit in anywhere. I felt like I was this square peg trying to fit into a round hole, and wherever I went, it just didn't fit. And everyone else seemed to be just, you know, coasting through life and figuring it all out. And I was like, what's happened? I've totally missed. I've missed the blueprint on life. I'm not getting this. So I don't think there was a specific crossroad as such, other than there definitely was a phase of my life when I didn't see sunny skies. I didn't see a light at the end of the rainbow, and a light at the end of the tunnel. And I just didn't see my world changing. And then there being a time when I felt like I could kind of influence that. And that was obviously as I got older, and I thought I might be able to actually carve out the life that I want. But I think for me, the biggest thing that I always held on to was my faith and education. That was drilled into me for such a young age. And for me, we didn't have money. We were extremely poor when I grew up. My single parent household, 3 children. So money wasn't flying around. I realized that education was going to be the only way that I could create the life that I wanted. And that was kind of drilled into me for a really young age. And I kind of just held on to that. That was it. Despite being homeless, despite being estranged from my family, I was always in education, college, university, doing my master's. I was always doing something to get out of my situation.
Can you share a story with us that kind of tells us a little bit more about what you were going through? Maybe, you know, the kind of darker side of where you were coming from, and that might perhaps help us to see your growth.
Yes, I had, as I mentioned, I had a really tough home life in terms of my parents not getting on, and there was a lot of unsettlement in the home. And then at the same time, I lost the 2 very close role models in my life, which were both of my granddads. So they passed away within 6 months of each other at the age of 11. My world felt like it was over. They cherished me, that I felt seen, I was spoiled by them. You know, I really was stabilized in so many ways because their kind of leadership and structure grounded me. So that was at the same time that I started secondary school. So I'd gone into secondary school with my second granddad passing away like just a month or two before, and my previous granddad passing away 6 months before. So I'm going to secondary school. My parents are going through a divorce. I've just lost both of my granddads. And then I go to secondary school, and very quickly, I'm not part of the in crowd. I'm just not. I'm not a conformist. I'm not willing to kind of like pledge my allegiance. I'm very much like a social butterfly. So I'm all over the place, and I'm with the artsy girls, and then I'm with the, you know, the sportsy kids, and then I'm with the, you know, boffin kids that really like to stay home and, you know, stay behind and do homework club. And I just didn't subscribe to the status quo. And for the, you know, the people that were the most popular, I really would have had to align with them, and I didn't. And because of that, I was an outsider. To the point where I was ousted. I was very much kind of picked on and targeted because I was not willing to say, to toe the line in that way. So all of that was happening. Fast forward to at age of 14, I took my first overdose. I was done. I was ready to be out of here. I was like, there's no hope. You know, there's no hope. Fortunately, it didn't work, obviously. But yeah, that was definitely... For 14-year-old, that was a lot going on. And there just seemed to be no place of rest wherever I went. And when I watched films like Pursuit of Happiness, I can so relate to that story, because it's just like knocking on doors and just getting knockbacks and just not knowing when am I going to get my break? When am I actually going to just get a break? So I think that probably is one of the parts in the book that's the most kind of dark, hard, challenging period of my life.
Was it difficult to write about?
Yes. I think some parts were easier than others. Some parts were surprisingly easy that were dark to write about. And I think that's where the cathartic bit comes from. To be honest, I think sometimes it was hard to write about, but it was harder to reread and edit, because you're then going back over it and like, no, that's not good enough. That's not descriptive enough. It's like, this is a really dark time. I shouldn't be kind of, you know, going over it with a fine tooth comb. So I think the rereading of it, and I mean, sometimes you'd send it to the publishers, they'd send it back to you to proof, and they're like, just proofed this chapter in, like, I really don't want to proof this chapter. I'm about to chill out for the evening and have a cup of tea and, you know, watch telly. And now I've got to sit and read about taking an overdose at the age of 14. So that was a bit, weird and a bit discombobulating. And like I say, there were periods when I just stopped writing for months on end because it was actually quite triggering. And I'm so grateful for my family because they had to bear with me through all of this, because if I've just written a chapter about a really difficult thing that happened at home and then I'm going out to dinner with them, sometimes it was a bit like, what's up with you? And it's like, really not in a good headspace right now. So it was really challenging. But for me, the message was more important than the process. I just had to get through it because I just feel like my story will really, really help other young 14-year-old girls that are struggling and grappling, and boys that are struggling and grappling with those same things.
And that's exactly what I was thinking about. What would you directly say to those young people who were in a similar position to where you were when you were 14? How would you tell them to try and work with it so that they don't feel that suicide is the only way?
I mean, it's hard for me to take credit without saying that my faith has absolutely grounded me. And I know that my story would be so different without the love of Jesus Christ. I have to put that out there as a disclaimer. And on top of that, I would say there's something I watched the other day. It was really powerful because I'm involved in quite a few mental health groups, young people empowerment groups, those kinds of things. And I saw this message and it was so powerful. And this girl just said, I just want you to know that if you weren't here tomorrow, you would be missed. And I think that is the message. That really is the message. You will be missed, because when you're in that really dark place, it helps to tell yourself. And I watch so many stories on the news where people have taken their lives, celebrities are on TikTok, and then 6 hours later, they've taken their life. And you're like, how? And I know only too well, they had to have convinced themselves that everyone would be better off without them here. And it's the biggest lie ever. So for me, that is what I would say to people, that you will be missed, and you not being here would make such a great impact on people around you. You matter, and the world would not be as good as it is without you in it. That's honestly the message that I would have wanted to hear.
Well, it's been a joy, you know, listening to you. It's made me think about all different times of my life, and also the way that I've faced when other people have told me about how they felt. You know, these things are so important, you know, family support, you know, spiritual support, love of God, all mm-hmm. these things, they all come together to make us who we are. And mm-hmm. I believe the stronger we love our God, the stronger we love our family, the stronger that we love ourselves, the better people we become to help not just ourselves, but all those people around us, even if we don't know them.
So, beautiful. I love that. You need to write a book. That's
fantastic. My father has been behind me for years to do that. Oh. And I just don't feel I have it in me to sit down and write it. And
you'll be surprised.
So I always admire when I talk to an author like yourself, I always admire, because it takes a lot of time and also a lot of soul searching. You know, it doesn't really matter what type of book you write. There is some soul searching. And if you're going to write something as deep as yours, it can, as you say, put you in different mind frames, different moods, other people around you. You know, they somehow get affected, even if you try not to. Then they worry about you. You know, they'll worry. They say, are you sure you want to write this? Yeah. Are you sure you're strong enough? And then at some point, you might even have doubted your strength in writing it. Yeah. Oh, people, I wish you could see her face.
I'm nodding away here going, yes, yes, yes. You're literally speaking through my whole process. Right now, and still scared a little bit. Still scared a little bit, if I'm honest. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's life. We are all, you know, we all have to face our little demons. And no matter how confident we all may seem on the outside, we all have something on the inside. It doesn't matter who you are. And I'm very surprised. Frightened sometimes when I think of the percentages, when I see percentages over the years where they say that each and every one of us have had some form of depression in our lives, each and every one of us. It's, you know, it's a huge percentage to think of. But if we have to be real about it, it's true. We all have. We just have to own it and try to come over on the other side. So, Nicola, before we say goodbye, tell us where we can buy your book.
Yes. So thank you so much. So Victory Is My Name is the name of the book. And it's actually a breakdown of my name, Nicola, which is Victory of the People. But Victory Is My Name.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You like that? So Victory Is My Name is available now in all online retailers and in stores.
Well, Nicola, thank you so much for being here, and all the best with your book. And I can't wait to get my hands on it instead of reading a synopsis. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now let's explore the anthropomorphic image of the bird a little further, specifically in the world of contemporary literature. Though this allegory isn't explicitly caged, it is vital to the history of the metaphor nonetheless. Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird entered America's national consciousness in 1960. If we examine the title of the novel without the knowledge of context, we are presented with the image of a murdered mockingbird, a bird that simply mocks or imitates the words of others. These avian characters are renowned for their unique ability to mimic, which, on a moral scale, would render them innocent, since whatever is spoken or sang is merely the imitation of another. It must also be acknowledged that the title is devoid of the verb, how, much like Angelo's caged bird, and its similar lack of action. The permeance of these titles is arguably the most poignant device, for a caged or even murdered bird may one day attain freedom upon its release, but the systemic entrapment remains. However, with the events of the novel in mind, which actually precede 1960 by 30 years given the setting of the 1930s Alabama, the title encapsulates the plight of the socially segregated or caged innocent, who is synecdochically representative of a much larger community and is ultimately deprived of freedom due to a justice system designed to prelude certain members of society from fair application of the law. Now, as the novel draws to a close, the reader learns that Tom Robinson lost his faith in the appeal and the belief of his lawyer, Atticus.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal. I'm no idealist. To believe firmly in the integrity of our courts and of our jury system, that's no ideal to me. That is a living, working reality. Now, I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence that you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this man to his family.
It seems that the mental cage was ultimately far more oppressive than Tom's physical cage of the prison walls, for the complete eradication of hope and faith in the appeal prompted his decision to run towards the wall and suffer the firing of fatal gunshots. It appears that the act of caging can occur at birth, in adult life, and even in death. It can manifest as a physical cage, mental entrapment, conversational exclusion, and of course, the harsh lines of racial segregation. It perhaps should not be surprising to us that the metaphor of the caged bird that Angelo did so much to popularize can be found in Lamarr's recent work, not only was one of Angelou's most notable poems, Still I Rise, reappropriated as a song title by Lamar's idol, Tupac. But Angelou herself actually appeared in a guest role on Lamar's seminal 2012 project, Good Kid, Mad City, which takes the form of a concept album detailing the life of Lamar and his friends growing up in Compton. At the end of the song, Sing About Me, I'm Dying of Thirst, a voice can be heard leading Lamar and co. in a group prayer.
Lord God, I come to you a sinner.
Lord God, I come to you a sinner.
And okay, repeat after me. Lord God, I come to you a sinner.
Lord God, I come to you a sinner.
And I humbly repent for my sin.
And I humbly repent for my sins.
Rather cyclically, this is the real voice of Angelou portraying a figure attempting to free Lamar and his friends from the crime-oriented mentality that has been created by their surroundings, calling on them to instead accept that a better future, that a life of freedom, is possible for them all. Thanks for listening to this episode of Metaphorically Speaking. I do hope you enjoyed it and will tune in again for the next one. I'd also like to thank our wonderful guest, Nicola Morrison. It was such a pleasure to talk with her. Don't forget, if you'd like to suggest a metaphor for an upcoming show, you can reach us at info@metaphorically-speaking.uk. We'd love you to share the show with your friends, and please feel free to leave a review on colourful.com or on our podcast, Metaphorically Speaking, which is on Apple, Spotify, and all major streaming platforms. We truly depend on you to help us grow so we can produce the best content for you to enjoy. Don't forget to join us.
Colourful Radio.
You understand what I'm saying?
R&B classics coming up on Colorful Radio. We are not playing.
One, two, three, four.
Yeah. What's up, girl? Let me holler at you for a second. I just want you to know all those other girls, they never meant anything to me. You're the only one for me.
You turn me on, sound so good, talking fast. But before we go on, there's something I should ask. Not about your past, cause I don't care who came before me. No, my maturity's bigger than that. I am more curious about what you truly want. Do I see sincerity?
the same way too. Me in the backseat, cause I know for sure that it's not me to let you drive. It just don't feel right. Oh yeah.
Too many hurts, too many feelings. Oh. Shouldn't be easy just to say I'm not changing, I'm walking away.
Ooh.
Commit, you could.